Hey, Enterprisers, thanks so much for joining us for our deep dive of the Tholian Web. So, of course, Steve and I are very sad to hear about the passing of the legend, Nichelle Nichols, at the age of 89. And we are going to be doing a special tribute to Nichelle Nichols and Uhura on a special upcoming episode of Enterprise Incidents. But for right now, we wanted to dedicate this deep dive of the Tholian Web, which is a great Uhura episode, to the wonderful Nichelle Nichols. Enjoy.
Since you are playing this tape, we will assume that I am dead. And the tactical situation is critical, and both of you are locked in mortal combat.
Bridge to all decks. Welcome aboard a brand new episode of Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve. I'm Scott Mance.
And I'm Steve Morris. And Scott, I really wanted to say how much I appreciate those taped instructions you left me on what to do if I ever have to do this podcast without you. It was really great.
What taped instructions are you referring to? I've been too busy, you know.
The taped instructions that you apparently...
I've been too busy prepping for this episode of the Tholian Web, so I haven't had a chance to, you know, any recorded message at all. I don't know what you're talking about, but so that's the setup here. Of course, we are very excited to dive into one of the finest episodes, certainly of the third season, and definitely one of the most beloved episodes of the original series in general, and that is the Tholian Web. And we are very, very excited to be joined by one of the writers of the Tholian Web. Welcome aboard Enterprise Incidents, Judy Burns.
So nice to be here. Hope that I can make the voyage interesting.
Oh, we have no doubt that you will. Very excited. We're all very excited to hear your insights into the making of this episode. But before we get started, I want to ask you, Steve Morris, like, what have been your thoughts about the Tholian Web over these decades?
I've always liked it, and I've always thought that it was a really cool, first of all, idea of an episode. And although I don't know how Bill Shatner felt about it, the fact that he was removed from the episode and we could really focus on the relationship with McCoy and with Spock is something I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, it's funny you brought that up, because that's one of the things that I always appreciated about the Tholian Web, is that even though Captain Kirk is missing for a good 75% of the episode, it actually feels like he's really there because of the way that he's missed, because of the way particularly that Spock and McCoy are missing him. So even though physically he's not there, his presence is sorely missed, and that makes him feel like he actually is there. I've always found this episode to be really moody and atmospheric. It certainly looks very different from any other episode of Star Trek that had been produced for the original series. And also, Judy, I don't know if you've had a chance to go back and watch some of these episodes with the new visual effects that they did back in 2007. Have you had a chance to see the Tholian Web with the new visual effects?
Probably not.
I don't have
a collection of Star Trek. If I happen to see it on the air, I watch, but I haven't got, you know, a box collection of anything, and I probably don't even have a copy of the Tholian Web except a download of an MP4 file.
Oh my goodness. We must do something about that, Judy. But so back in 2007, some beloved veterans of the later Star Trek shows went back and sort of updated the visual effects, the exterior shots of the Enterprise for, you know, the 21st century, for the digital age, high definition. And almost every situation, the visual effects have actually enhanced the quality of the overall episode. The only one episode where I prefer the original visual effects is the Tholian Web. These visual effects, which were done in 1968 by Mike Minor. Yeah. I still think those visual effects really hold up. The Defiant really does look like a ghost ship with the way that it has that animation around it. And of course, the way the Tholians are building their web about the Enterprise, you know, 55 years later, I think that it really does hold up. But, you know, this is an episode that came with some drama behind the scenes, and we will get into it, because it was directed by Herb Wallerstein. That's the credited director of The Tholian Web, but also Ralph Senesky, who was not credited with directing this episode. He directed the first 3 days, and when he was running about a half day behind, he was replaced by Herb Wallerstein, and there was a lot of drama behind the scenes with that, unfair against Senesky, and we'll get into that a little bit. But the episode aired on November 15th, 1968. The Tholian Web was the 64th episode of Star Trek to air, but it was actually the 65th episode to film, over 6.5 days between August 5th and August 12th, 1968. Despite the drama, the total cost for the Tholian Web came in at $175,924, which brought it about $2,500 under budget, which is actually pretty remarkable considering how ambitious this episode actually looked. So my first question, Judy, just to kind of set the record straight. So did the Tholian Web actually win an Emmy, or was it just nominated for Outstanding Achievement in Special Photographic Effects?
Better ask the TV Academy, because I don't know. I know it was nominated, you know, and when they did the TV guide little blurb, the second time they played it, had nominated for Emmy Award. I never looked to see if it actually won it, but it could have. I mean, Mike Minor deserved it. There's no doubt about it. Those frames had to be hand-etched themselves. So everything that you see that's a web was done by hand scratching.
Amazing. Amazing.
So it's amazing. And it was really a spectacular scene, you might say, when this web happened. So I wouldn't be surprised, but I have no idea. It just goes to show when you move on, and I'd already moved on to Mission Impossible, that, you know, I kept in contact with the guys down below, but they were all gone very shortly. And so after that, Star Trek just went away.
Yeah, for a little while anyway.
Yeah, but I still have it. Too bad you can't see it. Maybe you can by the end of the episode. I have the original TV guide of the three guys standing together with their autographs. It was the last thing that I did while on Star Trek.
Well, Judy, I want to ask you, how did you and your writing partner, Chet Richards, come to solicit an unsolicited teleplay for the Tholian Web, which at that time wasn't even called the Tholian Web? It was called something different. What was it?
It was called, in essence, nothing, because the ship that we were after and the character that would be floating in space were not there. So they were, in essence, nothing. I like the title now better. I think it's a better title. In terms of how it happened, a year before, while I was at UC Irvine, another writing friend and I wrote a script, and I was tutoring Buddy Ebsen's children in mathematics. And I asked Buddy if he knew an agent. He didn't know an agent, but he did know Tom Blackburn, who wrote Davy Crockett. And so he called over, and Tom Blackburn did something you never do, which is read the script. He called his agent, and that night I got an agent who was an old Walt Disney story editor, Polly Connell. Wow. And so that script, the one that was the year before, got submitted and disappeared into space. Never found again. Okay. So the next year, I was very poor, but I managed to get into an extension class at UC Irvine in writing with Bob and Wanda Duncan. And at near the end of the year, they said, what's happening with the script? Because all that year, I'd worked on the next script. Chet was an engineering student, and I needed him to tell me how to make interfaces, to basically be the scientific part of the team, even though I knew a lot about physics. And so the two of us took this class all year. And at the end, I said to Bob, you know, I'm afraid it's going the way of the other script. You know, it's just going to disappear into Never Never Land. He picked up the phone and called Freddie Freiberger.
Wow.
Who was who had just become the producer and had worked with Bob many, many times. And within 3 days, we got a call and saying, we're going to buy it if you can actually do the job.
That's amazing. And I'm curious, were you a fan of Star Trek before?
Yeah, I was an avid fan. They used to have, what was the station that was it KHJ? The radio station that was right next to Desilu Studios kept running contests. If you won the contest, you got to go up and be on the set.
Wow.
It was clear I was never going to win the contest. And so I needed to make $2,500 to go live in Africa, to be a bone person. And I called Star Trek up and said, how much do you get for one of these? And they said $2,500.
Oh, perfect.
And so we're having, this is God talking or whatever. So while I was up in L.A. dating Bones, I went to the studio and Penny Unger took the call from the guard and said, okay, let her in. There's nobody shooting, so she can't touch any little green ears. And so I walked back to the Star Trek office. She gave me a Bible and two scripts and said, go, sin no more. And it was from those scripts that I actually really learned how to do this one. And basically Chet provided scientific gobbledygook and I provided plot. And that was
wow.
It.
Wow. That's a great partnership. So yeah. So your unsolicited teleplay was received by Paramount by the Star Trek offices on April 7th, 1968. And Judy and Chet proceeded to story outline on May 1st. They proceeded to a third revised first draft on June 25th. Then Arthur Singer, the story editor, did a script polish on July 11th. And it was that script polish from Singer is when the name was changed from In Essence Nothing to The Tholian Web. Singer did a second script polish, a final draft on July 30th, and then Freiberger did page revisions between July 31st and August 6th, right about the time that The Tholian Web was about to start filming. So as I mentioned, the directors were Herb Wallerstein and uncredited Ralph Senensky. So when Herb Wallerstein picked up the filming of The Tholian Web on the fourth day, a lot of the more difficult shots were already completed, the shots on the Defiant with the spacesuits. And I'll get into what those problems were that pushed back production. But Wallerstein was a director of TV shows like Gunsmoke, The Partridge Family, Happy Days, Wonder Woman, The $6 Million Man, and Barbary Coast, which starred William Shatner.
One of the things I should say while we're in the creative area is that the uncredited writer of this script is Bobby Justman. That's all there is to it. Bobby was given the first draft of this script, a draft I don't even have anymore. Okay, it's the draft where Spock was in space and not Kirk. He wrote an 8-page memo, which we were never supposed to see. But Arthur Singer very kindly gave it to us. And we followed his 8-page memo almost paragraph by paragraph in our rewrites. Bobby was incredible. Bobby understood Star Trek better than I think anybody on the whole staff.
For sure.
And a big chunk of things that happened in this script, like he said, we've already got a script with Spock out there, but Kirk is such a schmuck, he'd want to stay behind. Let's do Kirk. These are the kinds of things that he wrote in his memo. But his memo was precise, and it was almost everything that you see in this script came from him, including the last will.
He didn't tell us
how to write it. He just said, we had a last will from somebody like the season before. I wonder where the writers got that idea. And they said, we want this, but this time it'll be between two characters that we want to expand their relationship so it'll work better. And so we went off and wrote it.
So often when you get notes from executives, they are not necessarily ones that are so helpful. And hearing that you got 8 pages of super helpful notes is really cool.
Yeah. I had Bobby come back and he would always come to my screenwriting classes. He was such a gentleman, but I mean, I credited him with the writing of this show basically, because even though he never sat in the story editor meetings, everything that he wanted got into this script.
You know, Bobby Justman, or Robert H. Justman, as he's credited, he was such a creative force for Star Trek. His memos are legendary, the way they would go on and just be so meticulous. And he, you know, Steve and I on Enterprise Incidents here, we've discussed in great detail so many of the ideas that Bob Justman had that made it into the finished versions of the episodes. And when you think about just like the Fab Four of Star Trek, you think, of course, of Gene Roddenberry, you think of Gene Kuhn, you think of Robert H. Justman, and of course, Dorothy DC Fontana. So those are the four most creative forces of Star Trek. So to have memos from Bob Justman, no matter how long they were, I would say, you know, even though it was constructive criticism, to get a memo from Bob Justman was a badge of honor for you and for Chet.
Yes. Well, we can thank Arthur Singer for that, because I don't think we were supposed to see it, but Arthur basically said, do what he says.
Sure.
That's great. That's great. Would you like to know some of the things going on in the world when this episode was being filmed?
Always.
Sure. Lovely.
So it was shot between August 6th and August 12th in 1968. And the first thing is, on August 6th at Cape Kennedy, the U.S. Air Force snuck down to the launch pad in the middle of the night with the intent to secretly launch a satellite. It's not easy to secretly launch a satellite. And there were a whole bunch of reporters who saw it and said, what the heck is this? Is this the U.S. military? Is this a spy satellite? And basically, it was so outed that they had to sheepishly say, yeah, we might have launched a spy satellite in the middle of the night. And this was the first of 7 spy satellites, part of what's called the Canyon Project. On August 7th, Richard Nixon was officially nominated at the Republican National Convention.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a good one.
Which also means that we're coming up on the Chicago Convention, the Democratic National Convention, and that is certainly going to be some interesting news. More than 1,000 people drowned in Gujarat, India, after heavy monsoon rains caused the river to flood, and that was later controlled by a giant dam called the Ukai Dam. On August 8th, Spiro Agnew was named as Nixon's potential VP.
Oh my gosh. Very interesting
guy, Spiro Agnew.
For sure.
I spent a long time not mentioning all the plane crashes that were going on at this time in the 60s. There are 2 more this week. Wow. And from now on, it blows my mind how safe air travel has really become, because it's such a rarity now, and it was not a rarity then.
You took your life in your hands.
Yeah. The last steam passenger train in Great Britain came to an end. No more steam rail. This one's kind of crazy. On August 12th, Israel obtained 2 fully functioning MiG-17s. Mm. Want to know how they got them?
From the United States.
Nope. A couple of pilots in Syria got lost, mistook a landing strip in Israel for a landing strip in southern Lebanon, and landed in the wrong place. This one's strange. On the same day in Nanning, which is the capital of Guangxi province in China, they began a 7-week festival called the Beast and Fowl Exhibit. And what this was they grabbed all sorts of people that were branded enemies of the state by the Cultural Revolution, tied them up, put them in wooden cages, strapped signs on the front of them saying what their crimes were, whether it was treason or espionage. And people, for a period of 52 days, 500,000 people in China came to view these prisoners held in wooden cages.
I have a footnote, Steve, to what was happening during the week when these episodes were filmed. So I think it was either the last episode, The Empath, or the episode before that, Is There in Truth No Beauty? You said to me, hey, do you know what happened on this day? It has something to do. You were alluding to the Beatles, which is my other obsession next to Star Trek. And I said, oh, was it the Mad Day Out where the Beatles went all over London with a photographer and took all sorts of new publicity shots all over the place in London? And you said, no, it was like the Apple Boutique closed down. Okay. Well, the reason I'm bringing this up is because as we are recording this episode, this podcast episode for the Tholian Web, today is July 28th, 2022. And it was on this date, July 28th, that the Beatles did their Mad Day Out marathon photo session all over London. So I just wanted to just throw that out there that I was not that far off the mark, Steve Morris, with the Mad Day Out.
I think you were pretty darn close. That is, I never cease to be impressed, Scott, with your ability to remember dates.
Serendipity.
Yeah. Shall we get into the episode, The Tholian Web?
Let's do this. I'm so excited. And when we get into our scene-by-scene breakdown, when we get to the end of the teaser, Steve, and at the end of Act 1, I have some things to say regarding the production that goes back to the transition between Ralph Senensky and Herb Lowerstein, and it's pretty crucial.
Okay. We will definitely talk about that. So in the teaser, we start on the bridge and we see everyone looking fairly concerned. And what we hear is that they are approaching the last position of the Defiant, which vanished without a trace 3 weeks ago in uncharted territory.
So Judy, how did you come up with the starship Defiant? And was it called the Defiant in essence, nothing?
No, it was not. It was called a Scimitar. And it was called the Scimitar because we wanted to be international in sounding of the ships. But very quickly they said, no, we need something a little more generic. And so we just came up with the Defiant, and that's what it was. Sounded good.
Yeah, it does sound good.
I think it's a great name.
Captain, we're registering very curious readings from all sensors.
Specify.
I cannot. According to our instruments, space itself is literally breaking up. There is no known phenomenon which would account for these readings.
One of the things that we've talked about throughout this podcast is that one of the central things that makes for a good episode of Star Trek is interesting science fiction ideas. I think this episode in particular is packed full of interesting scientific ideas. And this is the first one, which is the idea of space itself breaking apart.
I still think that is like you, Steve, I've always been fascinated by that concept. And I love the setup for this episode. They filmed the scene on the bridge on day three of the filming of the Tholian Web. So this scene that we're seeing on the bridge with Captain Kirk on the bridge was directed by Ralph Senensky. And over the years, I've always been drawn right into this episode because of the intensity, because Steve and I have talked about so many times that when you start a scene, it's already underway. It's always so effective because you're immediately feel like, what is going on?
The other thing that happens is a really good plant. Again, this is really good classic screenwriting technique, which is our plant is we hear Scotty say we're losing power on the warp engines.
Yeah.
How bad is it?
We can barely read it, but I don't like the looks of it, and I cannot find out the cause.
It's so important to, and Judy, you could speak to this of like, why is it so important to plant these ideas early on?
I didn't know very much about screenwriting those days, but the idea of coming threat, of foreshadowing, it was always in my mind. We had to time lock our problem so that, Star Trek is full of time locks where you only have a certain amount of time in which to get things done. And so any complication like warp engine failure or not being able to deal with the sensors gives you a time lock and gives you further complications. So it had to be there right away.
Also, if you're watching the episodes in production order, which is the way we cover these episodes on Enterprise Incidents, you would notice two things right away from this teaser after, The Empath, but certainly before in Is There in Truth No Beauty? And that is that both James Doohan and Nichelle Nichols are sporting different hairstyles. We have Yes, we have previously talked about, Judy, how Jimmy Doohan wasn't crazy about his hairstyle in the beginning of the third season when he had slicked it back. So he cut it really short and combed it forward, kind of looking like the buzz cut that you see here in The Tholian Whip. But Nichelle Nichols also changed her hairstyle. And Gene Roddenberry actually wrote a memo to the producers of Star Trek saying that he didn't really like the way that Nichelle changed her hair. He thought it made her look a little older and not as attractive as she was in the first two seasons. So I just thought that was kind of interesting that that's what Roddenberry picked up on.
I'm really glad we got rid of Scotty's hair from the first several episodes of the third season. I did not like that. And the next thing that happens is we spot the Defiant. But it's strange because we can see it, but the sensors
indicate it is not there. And it's such a it's so, you know, with all the techno babble that we would come to hear in some of the later Star Trek shows like The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and so on, the way that the writing from the original series, especially right here with the Judy that you and Chet did with The Tholian Whip, they're setting up a very science fictiony type of element, but not over explaining it to the point where it doesn't make sense. And as the Enterprise closes in closer and closer on the Defiant, and Kirk sees the familiar outline of a Constitution-class starship, but it's not just like the starship is out there looking like a starship right out there in space. We see immediately that there is something strange going on with the Defiant. There is this shimmering glow around it that, like I said at the top of the conversation, really makes it look like a ghost ship. And it's scary in a way that this starship that looks just like the Enterprise, and we have seen other starships that look just like the Enterprise, not make it, like in, of course, the Doomsday Machine. But also we lost a starship in the Ultimate Computer. We heard about another starship being destroyed in the Immunity Syndrome. And now we're seeing another starship here in the Defiant is in dire straits. So the whole concept of a ghost ship, Judy, where did that idea come from?
I wanted to tell a ghost story. When I first approached Chet, I said, one thing they haven't done is tell a ghost story. And so I would like to have a reason for something to look like it's there, but not be there. Two-dimensional is what I said. I want two-dimensional. And so if Kirk or Spock in the original one was going to appear that way, then I assumed that the ship was going to be that way. And so it's exactly as it was described in the script, kind of this green shimmering effect. Mm-hmm. And it worked. They did a great job.
Oh, they sure did.
I think it works really well. And it becomes very scary as we get into Act One. And right now we try to hail them. No response. So Kirk orders Chekhov, Spock and Bones to the transporter room. And we're in the transporter room and they're wearing these spacesuits. And yet they don't look like shower curtains. Scott, where did these come from?
All right. So Judy and Steve, let's talk about the spacesuits. On one hand, of course, Steve, you know, you're referring to the shower curtains that they used in The Naked Time, which was like laughable. The only thing that redeemed the Naked Time was that everything else about that episode was really great. So these spacesuits were created by costume designer Bill Tice. Mike Miner helped with the construction of the helmets. The spacesuits were made from a slick material resembling silver lamé, and guess what? Featured no zippers. So when the actors had to, use the gentleman's room, they had to remove the spacesuits completely, put them back on, and have them sewn up. The problem is that when day one of the Tholian Whip started production, which was on Monday, August 5th, with this scene in the transporter room, the spacesuits arrived late, had to be sewn on. They did not get ready ahead of time. Production manager Greg Peters and costumer Andrea Weaver, along with Mike Miner, didn't have the suits ready in time. They didn't do any tests the previous Friday or over the weekend. They were going to test it out right now on this Monday morning, the first day of production. And that caused delays in production immediately. And this was after Ralph Sinensky's previous episode, which was Is There in Truth No Beauty? Steve, as you recall, he faced production delays on the first day of shooting that episode. So now he's facing production delays on this episode. And on top of that is the fact that this was the first episode, The Tholian Web, that featured the new cinematographer, who was Al Francis. Al Francis was previously the camera operator, but when Jerry Finnerman left Star Trek after almost 2.5 years since the Corbomite maneuver to make a movie with Sidney Poitier, Al Francis took over, and his setup, it was taking a little bit longer for him to get the lighting set up to make it look just kind of like Finnerman, but also give it his own spin. So there was like already two problems that were causing delays in the production. And that was already setting director Ralph Sinensky off on a wrong footing. And unfortunately, you know, these were very, very complex scenes to film because of the lighting and because of the spacesuits. But Judy, what did you think when you saw the spacesuits for the first time?
We don't want to hear what I thought because they walked right by me. And I went, what the heck is that? Uh-huh. And especially because the script, the original script, and one of the reasons Bobby loved the script, the first one, was these suits, these force belts that were in the original. There was no space suit. You just put on a force belt and it made a force field around you. So the force field protected you from hot, cold, lack of air, everything like this. And he went, wow, this is so great. But somewhere along the line, from the top down, they went, well, if we have these force field suits, we'll never be able to put them in danger again.
Right.
And so goodbye force field suits, which would have been so cool, because as a ghost wandering around with a force field thing, you wouldn't have this suit in between you and him. But it happened, so what the heck? Could tell it was going to be trouble, though.
That is another really cool science fiction idea, and one that is in other science fiction things, you know, decades later. So, Judy, you were way ahead of your time. That's really cool.
Judy, the idea of using those force field belts that would just, you know, protect the landing party no matter what hostile environment they were on. You're right, it would have made them invincible, but they must have liked the idea, certainly some of the writers and producers of Star Trek, because when it came to the animated series, those life support force field belts did make their appearance in the animated series of Star Trek.
I know.
I want to say one other thing about this issue with the spacesuits and the timing is that the person who, now I don't know what went on exactly, but one of the people that's obviously to blame is the AD and the production staff, because you should never schedule costumes like that with, you haven't had time to test, yep, with a new cinematographer on day one. They should have put it later in the schedule, and then you wouldn't have had this problem.
Let's put it this way. It gave us a lot of time to talk to people on the set while they worked out the problems with these suits. We were there a half a day doing nothing while they fiddled with these suits. And then finally, all of them tripped through and went over to the transporter and stood there.
Oh, wow.
But we are in some spacesuits, and we do beam over to the bridge of the Defiant. And the first thing that we see is a red guy with his hands around the neck of the dead captain, and they are both dead.
Wow. Yeah. And that's a chilling scene. First of all, the when you get to the Defiant, I got to say, Al Francis, I mean, his cinematography for the Defiant was very, very effective. So much that you would swear that they actually built a whole new bridge set just for the Defiant. He really did a great job of making the Defiant bridge look so much different than the Enterprise. And the image of having Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Chekov standing there in spacesuits on the bridge of another starship is also very chilling, because now they're the one who look like ghosts on this other starship, the Ghost Ship. And so the captain of the Defiant, who has someone else's hands wrapped around his neck, the body of the dead captain, whose name we do not know, was played by Paul Baxley, who was a stunt coordinator or actor for the original series. And he also had a speaking role as Lieutenant Freeman in The Trouble with Tribbles.
Oh, that's cool.
So that brings us to the end of the teaser. And so keep in mind that moving forward, all of the scenes that we talk about taking place on the Defiant with the actors in their spacesuits were all directed by Ralph Senensky.
Yep.
We come back in Act One to the same spot, and McCoy is taking readings. And the first question we hear is,
has there ever been a mutiny on a starship before?
Because their thought is, this looks like a mutiny. That's what they think has happened. And there never has been. And Kirk walks into a close-up, and I can totally tell that's directed by Ralph. That's so one of his moves
He
likes to do. And we hear that the captain's neck is broken, but the ship is functioning. So the first thought is, there's probably still mutineers on this ship. So we're going to beam over security until we discover, no, there's no life left on this vessel.
It's such a mood of this episode. I remember when they started airing Star Trek in Philadelphia and WPHL at 11:30 at night, you know, so I would stay up late on nights that I could. And of course I would stay up and I would hold my little tape recorder up to the television and record the episodes because, you know, I didn't have a VCR up to that point. And when I was watching the Tholian Web, it was late. It was in the dark. My parents were asleep. My brother was probably out somewhere. And I was alone watching this episode, and I remember being pretty freaked out. I was scared.
That's good.
It is genuinely unsettling. Might be one of the most unsettling sequences in the original series, I think. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting to me is that there are many parallels to The Naked Time, but they're really different in terms of tone. Mm-hmm. You know, and Kirk sends Chekov down to engineering and life support, and McCoy is going to go check out sickbay, and we're back on the bridge of the Enterprise. Again, it's a nicely set up shot with Sulu in the foreground, Scotty in the midground, Uhura in the background. My guess is that's Ralph Senensky too, but I don't know.
Okay, so a lot of the scenes on the bridge that in which Kirk was not there, those scenes were actually directed by Herb Lauerstein later. Mm. Yes.
I can tell you that Ralph directed the scenes in the engineering.
Yep.
I was there and that it was right after that they let him go.
Were you there for every day of filming, Judy?
Yep.
That must have been awesome. I'm so jealous.
Hey, it was the closest I came to those little green ears.
It was
awesome. You know, what's interesting, though, is that what I didn't realize at the time is that here's this one soundstage, and right next door to this soundstage is the mission soundstage. And they're making magic over there. At the same time, there's magic over here. And within 3 weeks, 4 weeks, I'd be working for that side of the soundstage.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow. Uh-huh. So, Judy, what was it like? I mean, meeting like William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly. Did you like say hello to them?
Oh, I tried to be cool, you know, and not reach out and paw them, which is what everybody wants to do. They were all fantastic to us. I mean, both to Chet and myself. Chet was there some of the days, some of the times he was in a different location, but they were very kind, especially since we were so young. You know, still in college.
How did William Shatner, how was he to you knowing that you wrote a story in which he's not there for much of the time?
You know, I don't know, because he really was just very kind and open. And I have a feeling that it gave him some time off.
Yeah.
It's a much needed time off. And he loved his dogs and he loved his horses and what have you. So I think he just had time. I worked with him on T.J. Hooker, and whenever he got a chance to have some time off, he took it. In fact, there were times when I wrote things for Bill that other people did them.
Oh, wow. Mm.
He was not that uncool, I think.
We're back on the Defiant, and Chekov is in engineering, and then we see him wince. Okay. Something has happened to him.
Something is happening.
And, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, of the idea of the audience can be ahead of the the characters in the show with the characters in the show or behind them, this is a case where we're ahead. Is we go, oh no, something is going on here.
Whatever it was that happened to the crew of the Defiant is already starting to affect the crew of the Enterprise, starting with poor Chekhov. Guy can't get a break. He's always screaming, and he does that so well later in this episode. But Steve, what do we notice about Chekhov's point of view while he's starting to get disoriented by the effects of the unstable space?
Is he in a wide-angle lens?
Yeah, that's right, the fisheye lens. That of course was Ralph Senensky, who did such a great job of using that to depict the madness after Lawrence Marvick and Spock see the Medusan ambassador in Is There in Truth No Beauty.
That was the scene in Engineering I can tell you about. That was absolutely the one that his one of his last shots.
As scary as it was showing up on the bridge with these dead bodies, I think it's even scarier when we show up in sick bay and there are just bodies everywhere, some on the beds, some just strewn around. There's a lot of bodies in this episode. There are a lot with Chekhov and Engineering, too.
Report, Mr. Chekhov.
Just like what I found in life support. All dead.
And I think in Walter Koenig's performance, you can already see that something's wrong.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And Walter gave a really great performance, because when you look at the range of this episode of him being disoriented, really, really going mad, to showing up back as his old smiling self at the end of the episode, I think Walter's performance in this episode is right on point.
Bones, can you tell me what they all died of?
And McCoy's response, which again is chilling.
I'd say these people killed each other.
It's so weird how the Naked Time is doing some of this stuff, but it's fun in the first several acts.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And this is not.
Steve, you're right. I actually never thought about that because, you know, in the Naked Time, they're dealing with the disease and which they need a cure. And in this episode, they're dealing with just the effects of the space around them or not around them, and they need an antidote. So it's a little different. But you're right. In the Naked Time, there's a transition between like the fun of it all. You know, you're kind of laughing at it and with it until it becomes quite serious in the last act. It is extremely serious from the beginning moments of this episode, the teaser even.
Great drama.
Absolutely. And McCoy leans down to examine a body that's on the ground, and his hand goes right through it.
What the devil?
And then he goes to his desk, and his hand goes right through it.
Jim, this ship is dissolving. My hand just passed through a man and a table.
I think this whole Defiant, your ghost ship that you created, is a really scary place.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go there.
Yeah. And on the bridge of the Enterprise, they see that the Defiant is starting to disappear. So Kirk calls over and says, hey, beam us home. And that's when he hears that there's going to be a problem.
A cancer, at least not all at once.
Why not? What's happened?
Everything. That ship you're in is fading out, and it's ripping the innards out of this one.
So Judy, I'm curious, in terms of when you had your first submission for In Essence Nothing, other than the fact that in your original story, it was Spock who disappeared, and then it was changed to Kirk, what were some of the other differences from the teaser in your first screenplay to the version that we are seeing now, or the first act, really?
Not much, really. What disappeared was a lot of gobbledygook. In other words, a lot of scientific jargon that, you know, you mentioned that. There was scientific jargon that was floating around, and that was all cleaned up. Not by them. I mean, they said, take it out. And so we did. We cleaned it up. But the teaser probably was another page worth of that kind of stuff. And in the original, of course, it was Spock who disappeared. And because it was Spock who disappeared, we needed another science person. Mm. And so we had a character called Riley, who was the science person. And, of course, Riley disappeared instantly. And when the moment Spock stayed behind. So there were things like other characters floating around in the very first draft. That's about it. You know, all the way up through where we find the people dead on the Defiant, pretty much was there.
Gotcha. One of the things I find really interesting about this episode of Star Trek, and I mean this in a completely complimentary way, Judy, is that it shares elements of some of my other favorite episodes of Star Trek. We've already talked about the naked time. The other thing is now we have this moment where Scotty can't beam everyone back to the Enterprise, and someone has to stay behind. And of course, first Spock volunteers to stay behind. We all know that's not going to happen. Kirk's going to make him go. And this is like the doomsday machine, is that Kirk is the one who has to stay behind on the wrecked Constitution class starship where everyone else has died, you know?
That's one of the comments that, you know, Bobby Justman alluded to. These writers must have watched all the episodes.
Yeah.
And you guys indeed, know how,
yeah.
Steal from the best.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit rough, but Scotty manages to beam over McCoy, Chekhov, and Spock. Kirk is waiting on the bridge of the Defiant. They say energize. He starts to transport. They're having trouble with it. Chekhov is looking out at the monitor at the Defiant floating there in space.
So the image of the Defiant phasing in and out. I know that they did a really great job in the revised version of the visual effects back in 2007. Mm-hmm. But the way that Mike Miner and the visual effects people at Van Der Veer Photo Effects, they're the ones who handled the visual effects for the Tholian Web. The way that they have the Defiant phasing in and out, it still has that green glow, that shimmering green glow around it. It's chilling to watch a starship that looks just like the Enterprise phasing in and out of this space. So my question for you, Steve, in particular is, so here's Kirk who said, I will stay behind. You three get back to the Enterprise. The other three, Spock and McCoy and Chekhov, make it back to the Enterprise. And Kirk is standing there on the dark, silent bridge of the Defiant, and he's waiting patiently. And Shatner plays this perfectly because of how understated it is. Yeah. Kirk is standing there. He's looking around, and then you see Kirk look down at the dead body of the other captain with the red shirt, has his hands around the neck of the dead captain. And the other guys are trying to beam Kirk off the Defiant. It's not happening. Kirk is just standing there. So my question, Steve, is what is Captain Kirk thinking at this moment?
What is Captain Kirk thinking? My guess is maybe this is the time my luck finally runs out.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because when we saw a similar situation like this in the Doomsday Machine, where Kirk was the last man standing on the constellation, and the constellation is approaching the mouth of the Doomsday Machine, and the transporter is not working, and he's like, gentlemen, I suggest you beam me aboard. And he's standing there, and he's thinking at that moment, this might be my time. And of course, literally the last second they save him. So here he is back in a very similar situation, very different in terms of, like, you know, it's not going into the mouth of a big planet eater, but he's not beaming off the Defiant, and the Defiant is phasing out, and he knows this. So maybe he's thinking, like you said, Steve, maybe I am not going to make it. And in fact, he does not make it.
And the moment, it's underplayed so much in such a beautiful way, because it disappears and Chekhov says,
it's gone.
He doesn't panic. He just says, like he's scared by the fact that it's gone. The Defiant just vanished, and so did Captain Kirk.
And we have Scotty and Spock scrambling to try to do something to bring the captain back, and then they say,
there's nothing out there to grab a hold of and bring in. When that ship went, it must have taken the captain with it.
What a great ending of an act. What did you think when you first saw the complete episode? And, you know, not on the set, you know, not including the days that you were on the set watching the filming of it, but when you watched the finished version, you got to the end of Act One and Scotty makes that comment, says, oh, when that ship went, it must have taken the captain with it. Like, what were you able to forget the fact that you and Chet wrote this and just enjoy the suspense of it all?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was a... It was a great party. We had everybody from that script writing class there reacting to it. Wow. The Bob Duncan's class, everybody came. Uh-huh. And so everybody had the same reaction, which is, oh my God, how do we get out of this?
There is something really thrilling about hearing professional actors say your words for the first time. That's really cool.
That must have been awesome. I mean, you know, Judy, for you and Chet, and you said, you even said that you were like diehard Star Trek fans by that point, and you were young, and here you are watching your hero, like Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Scotty and even Chekhov say these words. That must have just been like, did you and Chet like look at each other and go, oh my God, this is so cool?
Kind of. The problem is you have to know something, and that is, and Chet acknowledges this too. When we were in the process of revising this script, he pissed off somebody. I don't know what it was, but he pissed off somebody. And they basically said, if you want to keep writing, you come in and alone. So from that moment on, I was the liaison that went there. So when it came to filming, Chet came up on his own and I came up on my own. By that time, basically, we were tied together only by one other script, the mission script, and that was kind of in chaos. So even though Chet and I are good friends to this day, we weren't tied at the navel on that set just because they had separated us.
Oh, I see. Well, some other things to point out. So first of all, when the Defiant phases out at the end of Act One, that is actually not the last time we will ever see the Starship Defiant, because the Defiant shows up again in Season 4 of Star Trek Enterprise in the two-part episode In a Mirror Darkly, which is a fantastic two-part episode of Enterprise. So when the Defiant disappears from with Kirk aboard, you know, with that timeline of Spock and McCoy, and it appears later, it actually means that the Tholian Web is a prequel to In a Mirror Darkly, because the events of In a Mirror Darkly take place after the events of the Tholian Web. But regardless, filming on the Defiant Bridge took place on days 2 and 3. And at the end of the third day of filming the Tholian Web, after being slowed down by a new cinematographer and after more trouble with the spacesuits, production was now a half day behind. So director Ralph Sinensky was called into producer Fred Freiberger's office and he was let go. And Sinensky on his website, Sinensky.com, and Ralph has been a wonderful guest on all of the 6 episodes that he had previously directed. And his website has a very detailed breakdown about his experience directing the Tholian Web. And he wrote on his website, "I think I shocked Fred Freiberger because I didn't come in begging to keep my job. The stuff we had done was all the big production stuff. The stuff we had left was what I called bread and butter scenes. And I quite frankly felt that I would have been able to get them done on time. And I didn't tell him that to keep the job. I think I let him know that I was happy to be gone." And we've talked to Ralph many times about how Star Trek changed from when he directed This Side of Paradise and Metamorphosis up until the point that he directed Is There in Truth No Beauty, and had problems here with the Tholian Web. And Freiberger told Ralph Sinensky that he was being replaced by, quote, a fireman, which is someone who could come in and get the job done. Now, many years later, Fred Freiberger's confidant, Peter Greenwood, said about the incident, said Fred hated doing that. He was not that kind of a person. At that point, Star Trek was a liability as far as the studio was concerned. Paramount hated Star Trek. Freiberger was in a horrible position, and the executive in charge of production at Paramount, Douglas Kramer, was a hard ass. So Fred hated the idea of switching directors in the middle of a production. He thought it was a damn fool move. And unfortunately, you know, like every one of Ralph's episodes are good or great or absolute masterpieces. And Judy, like when since you were there on the set of filming for the whole duration of the episode, like what do you remember seeing about what was going on there?
Ralph Sineski had fire. He was a fiery, wonderful. His charisma was overwhelming.
Oh, yeah.
You could tell the love he had for what he was doing. Herb, and I had a chance to work with him a couple of three other times. He was a yeoman and just came in and did the job. And you could tell that nobody, it was very debilitating to the crew, to the cast, everybody, because we all knew that it was not fair and that it was going to harm some of the scenes. That's all there is to it. Mm-hmm. And that was just on the set. Everybody knew it. It was devastating.
Well, what I do recall about Ralph Sineski talking to us about Bread and Circuses was that, Steve, remember this part of the conversation we were talking about filming, you know, in like Bronson Canyon and those scenes outdoors when they first meet the Children of the Sun? He said that he would do the harder scenes first to get them out of the way. Because, you know, he was also dealing with things like weather. You had to take into account the weather. So you would do the harder scenes first and get them done and then just do the easy stuff last. So that's what was happening here with the Tholian Web. He was doing the harder scenes first with the new cinematographer and the spacesuits. And once he could just like focus on the rest of this story, which really took place on the bridge of the Enterprise or on stage 9, that was what he called the bread and butter scenes. So there were bread and butter scenes at the end of Bread and Circuses, and there were now bread and butter scenes at the end of the Tholian Web, but he didn't get a chance to do them. And he was only running a half day behind. Other directors had run further behind, like a full day behind. Or, you know, when we get to talk about For the World is Hollow and I've Touched the Sky, that director, Tony Leder, ran a day and a half behind. So it just didn't seem fair what happened for Ralph to be replaced midway through production of the Tholian Web. But regardless, what is for sure about the Tholian Web is that the scenes that Ralph Sineski directed were beautifully directed, proficiently directed, and that will not change whether he's credited on the episode or not.
Agreed. Kind of like Richard Donner versus Richard Lester.
Yeah. This is a good example.
Great example, Judy.
There are a couple of things I want to say about this. The first one is that obviously our admiration of Ralph is, you know, we've documented it well over many episodes of the show. I want to just say what Ralph had very strong reasons for not wanting to come on and talk about this. And I just wanted to share what they were because it only made my admiration go up, which is what he said, Scott and Steve, what you guys are doing, you're creating this record of the original series, the official record in this way. And he said, I have very strong feelings about this and I want your show to be objective. And if I come on, it will be less objective. And I was like, wow, what a dignified and honorable approach.
Absolutely.
That's the first thing I want to say. And the second thing I want to say is, boy, a decision like this is so penny wise and pound foolish. You got a director who has a rapport with the cast, who has repeatedly put in, as Scott, as you said, anywhere from really, really good episodes to excellent, some of the best episodes of the show, period. And you go, because of a half day behind, I'm going to disrupt the cast. I'm going to make everybody angry and all just to save a little bit of money. And the fact is Ralph could pick up the pace and he maybe finishes under budget anyway.
Yep.
I have no doubt he would have.
It is a stupid, stupid decision.
I agree completely. And to second what you said, Steve, about Ralph's decision to not join us for our conversation here is absolutely admire his decision. I respect it. I completely understand. And, regardless of whether he joined us or not, I hope that we do right by telling the story of because there was no other episode that faced this kind of drama behind the scenes.
It was horrible.
And the other thing is these decisions don't happen in a vacuum. So this affects Ralph going forward. And that's really, really tragic. But I do have to say, as much as I miss talking to Ralph, who I love, I'm thrilled, Judy, to have you here. And that's a real, real treat.
I was going to just say one other thing, and that is, it's very likely Freddie did not have anything to do with this decision. I knew Freddie through many, many years after this. And I suspect, because I worked with Aaron Spelling, on Vegas, and Doug Kramer came over and did that show too. And I suspect Doug Kramer made this decision. Doug Kramer was famous for his memos too. Right. And I suspect that it came down from Doug Kramer's office. That's just my thought. Nice man, but boy, could he write memos that were slicing.
So we come back in Act Two, and there are two things going on simultaneously. The first is that we're in a discussion, a sort of scientific-y discussion about the space that we're in, and power from the ship has unbalanced things, and they're starting to drift, and all this stuff about the plot situation. But at the same time, something's going on with Chekhov. And I think Walter Koenig does a great job of ramping it up slowly, that things are going south with him.
I don't understand what's so special about this region of space.
And there is an aggression to the way he asks the question that is completely out of character. Spock comes back and is explaining very patiently. And we can, again, I'll just watch Walter Koenig.
If we are not extremely careful, we shall lose the captain and become trapped ourselves.
And I like him.
Boy, does he freak out. He goes nuts. And nobody screams better than Chekhov. And you know, Sulu was trying to restrain him. And then Spock is, you know, grabs his head. He's trying to reach into Chekhov. And from Chekhov's point of view, when you see Spock saying, Chekhov, that's done with the fisheye lens to depict the madness, again, that we saw vividly portrayed in Is There in Truth No Beauty? And then Chekhov's not hearing any of it, and Spock just applies the famous FSNP, the famous Spock neck pinch.
And after calling security for the bridge, he asked, did anyone notice anything peculiar in his behavior before this? And Sulu did.
I think he had several spasms of pain.
And again, this is us being ahead of the show, because we saw those dead bodies on that other ship, and we know that's what's coming for this crew.
Yep.
So they take him off to sickbay, and as they do this, McCoy says to Spock, and this is the beginning of the conflict.
Oh, and by the way, Mr. Spock, I think it might be a wise precaution to put some distance between us and the Defiant.
If we are to recover the captain, we must not move.
And he's calculated exactly what time the next interface will be. And then if Jim is still alive, they're going to be able to beam him back. And we also hear, again, you're creating more and more ticking clocks, Judy, because we have the space issue, which is a ticking clock. We have the warp drive, which is a ticking clock. And now we have how much air does he have in that suit? That's another ticking clock.
Right. Just so you know, at this point, probably they bought the episode. Because they realized they'd have a bottle show that could do this.
Right. Mm. That's right. Everything was filmed on stage 9. And you know, all it took to film the scenes on the bridge of the Defiant and even engineering in sickbay was just a change in the lighting. But yes, just like Is There in Truth No Beauty and A Line of Troyes, this is a bottle show. Everything was done on stage 9. Part of the reason why they were able to keep the budget under budget, or the cost under budget. And Steve, on top of all of this drama, it would have been bad enough that the Defiant phased out, that there's something going wrong with the warp engines and they're losing power. There would have, my gosh, Captain Kirk is gone. Are we going to get him back? And right at that moment, Sulu says, picking up something approaching, a vessel was approaching. So Judy, where did the idea, the concept, and the name of the Tholians come from?
The idea of the Tholians came from me. The name came from Chet. God bless him. I always thought of the Tholians as a crystalline people, the silicone base. And so everything that they had be silicone based. And we didn't want to do Klingons and Romulans. We just hated the fact that every time you turned around, there was a Klingon on stage or there was a Romulan on stage. And that was one of the things that Bob Justman commented on in his memo, which is, here we've got a third group come in. Do we want a third group coming in? And if we do, then we must not know very much about them. Mm. But that's funny, because Leonard Nimoy, in just a short time after this scene or two, ad-libs the most famous line of all, renowned Tholian punctuality.
Ad-libbed.
That was ad-libbed.
Oh, wow.
It said we knew a lot about them.
That's funny.
That's true.
I just want to point out, in some of the weaker episodes of Star Trek, there's only really one thing to be concerned about. And frequently, like in The Children Shall Lead, we're not even that concerned. In this episode, there's so many things to be concerned about. The only ones that I think compares is like Mirror Mirror, where there's multiple threats coming from multiple directions. And this one has, we have the region of space, we have the disease, we have Kirk's absence, and now we have the Tholians. That's four. Each one of those could be the plot of an episode of Star Trek.
For sure.
Hey, pack it in.
You are trespassing in the territorial annex of the Tholian Assembly. You must leave this area immediately.
So the Tholian mask was created by Mike Minor. And they tried to film it a couple of different ways before they figured out the right way to do it. So the scene of where they're doing the visual effects and filming the mask of the Tholians was done on the sixth day of production, on the final day of production. So first they try filming it against a black velvet curtain. And that didn't look so hot. So Mike Minor switched it, crumpled up some tinfoil, put it in the background, and they filmed that, added some enhanced effects, animated effects, and that is the version that you see on the screen in the Tholian web.
We claim this territory and are prepared to use force, if necessary, to protect our property.
You may not recognize the voice, Steve, but that is actually Barbara Babcock's voice.
Oh.
This is her fourth of five episodes. We would see her in her fifth episode, which was Plato's Stepchildren, but we heard her voice already as Trelane's mother in The Squire of Gothos, which I love goodness. That episode to pieces. And of course, she was Maya 3 in the Taste of Armageddon.
And I love Spock's response.
We are not interested in your display of force. The Enterprise is responding to a distress signal from one of our ships and is currently engaged in rescue operations. Do you wish to assist us?
Unfortunately, they don't see a ship. There's no ship here. What are you responding to? And we have to explain that there's this that they're interspatially trapped, and he gives the exact time that the ship is going to return. And they say, okay.
In the interest of interstellar amity, we will wait precisely 1 hour and 53 minutes. But be correct. We do not tolerate deceit.
So that's an impending threat that's just kind of hanging there over Spock and the Enterprise.
I don't know if it was in this script. I don't think it is. But in the earlier one, the Tholians had lost several ships in this region of space.
Oh,
interesting.
And so one of the reasons they were patrolling is because they wanted to know why the ships were disappearing. That was a factor for them, too, because the longer they stayed there, everybody stayed there, the more likely something was going to disappear. I think that got left out.
When you were talking about the Tholians in your earlier version, when it was still called In Essence Nothing, and you said that you had described them as being silicon base, which maybe, you know, they're kind of related to the Horda a little bit there. But my question, Judy, is when you were watching the episode and you saw what the Tholian, what Loskeen looked like, what did you think? Were you like, oh, that's really cool, or that's not what I had in mind? What did you and Chet think of the image of the Tholians?
Absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Loved it. But, excuse me, couldn't stand what they did on Enterprise, because I never thought of them as being a giant lobster.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I didn't like that either, actually.
Judy, I have a question. This literally never occurred to me until this very moment. But when you were describing that the Tholians had lost ships here, I suddenly went, oh, is this area of space the Bermuda Triangle?
Kind of. It was an area of space that was very frail, that was fraying. And I know that in recent years, they've done some interspatial stuff, I think even on like Picard or something. But at that time, nobody else had discussed the idea that space could come apart. And that was the whole idea.
Lock on to Captain Kirk's coordinates and prepare to bring him aboard, Mr. Scott.
And nothing.
Nothing's happening. Captain Kirk is not in his designated coordinates.
Well, I thought you had the thing timed out.
I did, Doctor. The space was disturbed by the Tholians.
And this is another little step in the conflict between McCoy and Spock.
Yep.
I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Steve and Judy, but there has been more conflict between Spock and McCoy in the third season than in the previous two seasons. Because, I mean, you know, we've had situations like in Bread and Circuses. I wouldn't really call it a conflict, but I would certainly call it a breakthrough into the understanding of their relationship in the jail cell scene in Bread and Circuses. But we're seeing, like, we just had in the Paradise Syndrome where McCoy was really, really kind of going after Spock for, you know, trying to destroy the asteroid. And now he is going to start going after Spock again here in Tholian Web.
Thank you, Bobby Justman.
Oh, is that another one of his?
Bobby Justman wanted to explore the relationship between Spock and McCoy. He really felt that they came at life in two different ways. One was intuitive, one was logical. And so he wanted this episode to delineate that.
Wow, Bob Justman. Amazing.
Yep.
You mean you don't know whether you're going to be able to recover the captain or not?
Not at this interphase.
I shall have to recalculate to determine when the next interphase will occur. They do not take place at regular intervals.
You can't wait for the next one. We've had another case like Chekhov.
I've had to confine my orderly to sick bay.
Spock just goes, well, that's essentially, he says, well, that's your problem to solve.
Yep.
And right as this conflict is reaching a high level, they're under attack.
The Tholians have opened fire. And this is where, Judy, where Nimoy's ad-lib line, renowned Tholian punctuality, comes in. And look, this episode, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of drama, a lot of conflict. And a lot of it, it's just really intense from start to finish. And it's now at the peak. And Spock is really feeling could come from all angles because, you know, McCoy is telling him, take the Enterprise out of here. And Spock is, and Scotty is saying, I know you don't like to use the phasers, but you got to do something about that ship out there. And Spock says, understood. And instead of like saying like lock phasers on target, he says, Uhura, open up a channel to the Tholians. Like he does not want to use the phasers if he does not have to.
Right.
There is a thing I learned directing is that frequently you have a decision to make and you have a million variables about making that decision. The sun has gone behind a cloud. The actor's performance was just okay. You got a lot of time problems. You got sound problems. You got all these things. And that what I learned was there is no way to know what the right decision is. You take the best information you have and you take your best shot.
Right.
There's so many variables going on with Spock right now. And there is no way to know what actually is the right decision. What will happen if you fire phasers? What will happen if you move? There's no way to know.
What's the use of this battle, Spock? You've lost, Jim. Take the ship out of here.
Ready, Mr. Sulu?
He's looking right at McCoy.
Yep.
The performance, the subtlety of it, of how restrained it is. You know, instead of Spock looking at Sulu saying, get ready to fire those phasers, he is looking right at McCoy saying, don't defy me. I know what I am doing. I know what I am doing, and I'm going to fire the phasers. And then he turns to the view screen and says, fire. Sulu fires the phasers. It's a direct hit. And again, the original visual effects are absolutely superb. I think the revised visual effects are great. But when I watch the Tholian Web, I go to my Blu-ray because the versions of Star Trek, the original series that are on Paramount Plus now, they're all the revised versions with the new visual effects. Mm. I take out my Blu-ray. I put my Blu-ray in just like the good old days. And I choose to watch the original version of the visual effects. And this is just among the finest visual effects in all of the original series.
That hit we took from the Tholians has fused our power supply converters. I can't do a thing with the Enterprise now. He's bound to drift. Maybe right through that doorway out there.
Can you estimate minimum time required for repair?
I don't even know if she can be repaired.
And McCoy jumps on this.
Yeah, he does.
Are you satisfied? Spock, why did you do it?
The decision to fight was logical. Lack of time prevented any other course of action. The Tholian ship had to be disabled.
And McCoy, you know, I love McCoy.
Yeah.
But there's so often that I'm Team Spock. It would not surprising knowing my personality, but...
You should have known what could have happened and done everything in your power to safeguard your crew. That is the mark of a starship captain like Jim.
Dig. That's ouch.
That's a low blow, man.
It is.
That's the whole idea.
Yep.
Doctor, I hardly believe this is the time for comparisons. Please go at once to your laboratory and search for an antidote to the effects of this space. That is your primary task, since we must remain here.
And he's right. I think Spock's right.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Oh, he is.
McCoy should not be on the bridge at this moment.
No.
By the way, he was on the bridge at this moment originally, because originally he had a variation of a compound that they were working on the other ship.
Oh.
And so he had come up to shoot people up when this was happening. That was taken out, but he remained. And so there had to be a scene written for it.
And then as McCoy is exiting, just to add one more piece of tension, another Tholian ship shows up. And I have to say, Judy, you know, we've talked about interesting science fiction ideas. This is one of my favorite interesting science fiction ideas of the entire original series. The two ships working together, creating the Tholian web.
This great science fiction idea that still holds up into the 21st century. The two Tholian ships connect, and as they depart, are building this web around the Enterprise. And for the next two acts, every time you see the Enterprise with the Tholians building this web around it, it's from a different point of view of the Enterprise. And there's this great shot. My favorite shot is when you see, like, it's an above shot of the Enterprise looking at the primary hull from above, looking at the Tholians crisscrossing each other, building the web. And I'm telling you, I know this was done in 1968, but today it looks fantastic. And as Judy pointed out, the web was created by Mike Miner. Every frame was hand scratched to create the motion. And by the way, Mike Miner also created the Melkoshian alien that we saw in Spectre of the Gun.
There is no analog to this structure in Federation technology. It is, however, an energy field. And if the Tholians are successful in completing this structure before we have completed our repairs, we shall not see home again.
Another great end to Act Two. Wow. I mean, so Judy, like, when you were watching throughout the filming of Tholian Web, and you were watching these scenes between Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly, and you were there, like, what were your observations of just their chemistry, their dynamic? Like, you saw the magic happening with your own eyes. I know the camera did too, which is why we have these episodes. But like, how did you – what was your impression after being a fan, after writing the episode with Chet and, you know, revising it with Bobby and with the – certainly with Arthur and with Fred? Like, how was it for you to see the two of them?
Satisfying, especially since, you know, the words – for the most part, all of those words are mine. And so, you know, to hear your words spoken, it never is quite the same. You can write a lot of shows. You can write 25 years of shows, and it'll never be the same as that first time.
Right.
And especially with the two people you might have liked most on the show. Mm. You know, I learned to like Bill. But it wasn't because I disliked him, but I loved Spock and McCoy.
Yeah.
And when McCoy got his own titles, I was overwhelmed with happiness.
Wow.
That finally they were giving him his due.
Yeah, right. Right.
That's one of the reasons I like Shore Leave.
Good McCoy stuff. We come back in Act Three and we are about to have a funeral service. And McCoy shows up and gives an update that the antidote, that they haven't found the antidote yet, but it might be some kind of Theragrin derivative. And Spock is like, what are you doing here?
My staff is working around the clock. My being there will not affect the biochemistry of any of the tests. This service requires my personal attention, Mr. Spock.
Why does this service require his personal attention?
That's a great question. By the way, this was filmed in the ship's chapel, which we saw in the episode Balance of Terror, and it turned into, you know, of course, the powerful final scene in Balance of Terror, also filmed in the ship's chapel. But this was filmed on day six. So it was filmed on the last day of filming for the Tholian Web. McCoy, why does McCoy need to be there? Well, his staff is doing everything they can. McCoy even says, my not being there will not help them or speed this along any more than what my staff is already doing. And
but it's more than that.
What is it, Judy?
I kind of call BS on that statement from McCoy.
No, because McCoy really believes that Spock doesn't have a nurturing bone in his body. He's not going to represent Kirk with feeling. And,
good point.
You know, his job is to be there, to be empathetic. And so to be told to go do something that's scientific instead of being there for his friend is horrible. You know, that's why he's there. He's there because, you know, Jim Kirk is his best buddy, his friend. And he doesn't think Spock will serve him well.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah, I've always gone, he's got more motive going on than he's saying. And I'll add, too, his general distrust of Spock at this moment and of him as the captain is also why he wants to watch this guy, you know?
But what you should realize is this scene served a different purpose once upon a time.
Hmm.
In this scene, Uhura got sick originally.
Oh.
And she ended up being taken out of this scene by McCoy to sick bay because she was, you know, she was fainting away. She wasn't becoming a checkoff, but she was really not right in the head. And so McCoy was there taking her away. That got taken out because Uhura ended up with her stuff later. But that scene had a different reason for being there to some degree. One, let's put the captain to rest. But two, let's see Uhura.
So Spock is at the podium and he gives, you know, basically a recap of what led to Kirk's apparent death. And he gets to...
But as a result of the battle, we must accept the fact that Captain Kirk is no longer alive.
And at that moment, another crewman goes absolutely bonkers, crazy, berserk. And that crewman is played by Bob Brauver, who was, you'd seen him in before in episodes like Dagger of the Mind and the Children Shall Lead. But watching, you know, it's different, Steve. I mean, you brought up the Naked Time. And I mean, it's such a great connection to make between the Naked Time and the Tholian Web, because where, you know, the Naked Time acted, it was a disease that acted like a drug, acted like alcohol. Here you have the effects of the space, and it's clearly having the same effect, driving everybody mad. And we've seen the effects of that because of every dead body on the Defiant.
Yeah.
So seeing the effect of the space now happening, now ravaging on the crew of the Enterprise is scary. It's scary watching the flies drop like this.
I also think the juxtaposition of Spock saying Captain Kirk is no longer alive with that guy freaking out.
Yep.
It just is really emotionally powerful in a really interesting way. And part of what makes it powerful is the camera pushing in on Spock. Like, I know Ralph isn't here at this point, but I still think that's a good camera move, and I think that Nimoy plays it just beautifully.
Yeah, that is a really interesting angle with the way, you know, Spock sort of steps forward and the camera zooms in a little bit on Spock. Very intense. It's all very intense.
And then Spock says, once things settle down,
I shall not attempt to voice the quality of respect and admiration which Captain Kirk commanded. Each of you must evaluate the loss in the privacy of your own thoughts.
And I will say that if McCoy was concerned that Spock was not going to be capable of emotionally doing what was necessary at Kirk's funeral, he was right. This is, you know, let's compare this to Captain Kirk's funeral for Mr. Spock in Wrath of Khan. Like, this is pretty weak.
Yeah.
Well, right. They've moved on in Wrath of Khan. Think about it.
Yeah.
The relationship's moved on.
That's true. Absolutely.
There is a duty to be performed in the captain's quarters, which requires our presence.
And Spock is like, no, I got to get back to work. I got stuff to do.
The captain left a message tape. It was his order that it be reviewed by both of us should he ever be declared dead. You have just declared Jim dead.
Again, Spock starts to get out of it.
The mental and physical state of this crew are your responsibility, Doctor. At the moment, they are your top priority.
The captain's last order is top priority, and you will honor that order before you take over.
He's got Spock trapped into a corner. Spock walks off, you know, through the court, through the door towards the captain's quarters, and then, you know, we are now in the quarters of James T. Kirk, And McCoy is opening up one of his awards, one of his medals, and says something that it's so eloquently summarizes the character of Kirk, his entire life. He was a hero in every sense of the word. I mean, what a great summation of Captain Kirk. He was a hero in every sense of the word. And that's so true. That's how I absolutely feel about Kirk.
Agreed. But the next part of the line, he says, and yet his life was sacrificed for nothing.
Yep.
And I'm like, no, it wasn't for nothing. You're alive because Kirk stayed behind. He sacrificed his life to save the other three guys that beamed over first. That is not true. And then he says,
the one thing that would have given his death meaning is the safety of the Enterprise. Now, you've made that impossible, Mr.
Spock. Came here for a specific purpose, Doctor.
Maybe not the same one.
I have something to say about Dr. McCoy.
Let's hear it.
He is, without question, his whole character is he is the most compassionate person on the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. His whole thing is to save lives, to care about people. But I will also say that Dr. McCoy is the meanest person on the Enterprise. He can be downright nasty. And this statement and several other things he says here are pretty darn nasty, I think.
But Steve, you're also talking about this relationship, this antagonistic relationship between Spock and McCoy. Where McCoy has always challenged Spock by trying to reach into his human half that is there, but is just being suppressed.
Missing one more thing.
What's that?
And that is, they're in a region of space that is changing people's heads.
Right.
Great point. So that's a great point.
McCoy is not McCoy at this moment in time. He's already being hurt by this moment in space.
And you're right, Judy, because we see McCoy kind of lash out at Spock a little later in the episode, and he's out of character. But at the same time, you know, McCoy is in character in the sense that he's trying to reach through to Spock's human half to appeal to that version of him, to bring out the empathy, if you will. You know, the episode right after, The Empath, which featured a lot of selflessness and sacrifice. But look at the fact that he is trying to reach into Spock's human half in this episode to like he's trying to say to him, like, Spock, you just declared Captain Kirk dead. You just declared your friend dead. Your friend who put his life and career on the line many times over, like when he got you back to Vulcan so you could do the Ponfar and the Calafi, and effectively died for that, you know, so we thought. But he's trying to reach into that part of him. That is why he keeps digging into Spock. I mean, yeah, he's mean on one hand, but on the other hand, he's saying, look, Spock, you're not just the Vulcan half. You're also the human half. Let's see that version of you too. Let's see that played out, because you just declared your best friend dead and you're not showing any emotion. No, you can do better than that. That's what McCoy is saying here.
But in the back of my head, just so you know, Spock was putting up a wall, because if he let the wall down and went human, the same thing could happen to him as happened to everybody else who's going nuts.
That's a great point.
That's an excellent point, Judy.
I mean, it's almost like you wrote this thing.
Well, that one was in the back of my mind.
The captain would have remained to recover a member of the crew at the risk of his own life or even the ship.
Yes, he would, Mr. Spock. But you didn't have that decision to make.
And again, I'm going to say, no, that's exactly the decision that Spock had to make, is that if I'm going to save the captain, I have to stay here and fight the Tholians. He said, and then McCoy takes it to an even another level. And this is, Judy, I 100% agree. The space is affecting him, because him saying,
you could have assured yourself of a captaincy by leaving the area.
As if Spock is making his decisions because he secretly wants to be captain. We all know that's not true. McCoy knows that's not true.
Absolutely agree. Completely.
It's the space.
I need not explain my rationale to you or to any other member of this crew.
And I like the way Spock puts this, because this is the way Spock thinks, but it's also in a weird way the way I think.
There is a margin of variation in any experiment. While there was a chance, I was bound legally and morally to ascertain the captain's status.
You mean to be sure if he was dead?
And then Spock kind of backpedals, like, look, if you think that I've acted irrationally, then relieve me of command. That's your primary duty as chief surgeon of the Enterprise. And then at that moment, Judy, I want to ask you, the final recorded message from Captain Kirk, who wrote that?
I did.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. What a perfect speech. What perfect delivery from William Shatner. His delivery of that speech is so right on point. It's restrained, but forceful in moments. It's so touching. It's so moving. It's a rousing speech that even though they're playing it because they're accepting that Captain Kirk is dead, there's still something about it that makes me think that it's bringing out the best in Kirk and Spock at this moment, to the point where even McCoy even says, he apologizes, he says, "Spock, I'm sorry." But this speech, for Kirk's recorded message, was filmed on day one. So that was directed by Ralph Sinetsky, perfectly delivered by Shatner. And also at this moment, it's when I realized that, I mean, Kirk disappears at the end of Act One. He's missing for, right? But he's there. He's there throughout because you're seeing the way Spock and McCoy need him. You're seeing the way the rest of the crew needs Captain Kirk. Just like Steve in Spock's brain, even though it's not a great episode, you're seeing the way that that Kirk needs Spock, that the rest of the crew on the bridge needs Spock. And they fill in for him when they're trying to figure out which planet to go to. But this dynamic has been so fully realized, especially between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And Judy, you and I have talked elsewhere about how, even though Star Trek was an episodic series in the sense that each episode stands alone, there really was an arc to these characters that spanned the entire series. And you yourself said that Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are different by the end of the series than they were at the beginning.
No doubt. They're what I call a classic triangle. What the power of writing the classic triangle is that if any two gang up on the third, it changes the dynamic for that episode. It shifts from person to person as to who's aligned with whom. So it gives you so many variations of the theme. And I can teach a whole class on that. But they basically become bonded as brothers in this episode in a weird way at this scene. And from that moment on, they're bonded all the way to Yosemite.
Yeah, for sure they are.
Since you are playing this tape, we will assume that I am dead. And the tactical situation is critical, and both of you are locked in mortal combat.
I love that because it so shows how well he knows these two guys and how much he cares about both of them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then he takes a moment for each of them and says,
"It means, Spock, that you have control of the ship and are probably making the most difficult decisions of your career. I can offer only one small piece of advice for whatever it's worth. Use every scrap of knowledge and logic you have to save the ship, but temper your judgment with intuitive insight."
I think this goes to something we've been talking about since the very beginning of Star Trek, which is the thing that's epitomized by Mr. Spock, which is Star Trek frequently is about the balance between logic and emotion, about the human side and the Vulcan side. And that's what Kirk is advising his best friend to be. Find that balance between the two.
"I believe you have those qualities, but if you can't find them in yourself, seek out McCoy. Ask his advice. And if you find it sound, take it."
Which is what Kirk has done through all of Star Trek, he needs McCoy. Even when McCoy is irascible and illogical and emotional and jumps the gun on things, he needs that.
And Kirk and McCoy, Steve, you and I pointed out many times that Kirk and McCoy have
battled
many times. They've had their conflicts. They've had their moments between each other where they lost their temper with each other more times than people really give it credit for. But he needs that.
"Bones, you've heard what I've just told Spock. Help him if you can. But remember, he is the captain. His decisions must be followed without question. You might find that he is capable of human insight and human error. They are most difficult to defend. But you will find that he is deserving of the same loyalty and confidence each of you have given me."
Which always moves me. Because at this moment, Kirk's dead.
Yeah, love that.
So what moves me, Steve, is what he says after that. He goes, take care. And that's it. That's the last they are going to hear of James Kirk. Right. And these words and Shatner's delivery of Kirk's final speech is why it is why William Shatner was born to play this guy. It is why it is the role of his lifetime. It is why we still are talking about this character and this show today. And whenever I watch The Tholian Web and I get to this moment, which was filmed on day one and was directed by Ralph Sinensky and just perfectly fully realized by Shatner, I still, doesn't matter how many times I've seen the episode, I still get full of emotion. I still get very emotional. And Steve, you know, I get emotional. Okay. I just got emotional when we did our deep dive of The Empath, which was an episode that was also full of sacrifice and selflessness on the part of all of our heroes, including Jem, finally. But the sacrifice that Kirk makes to stay behind on the Defiant is why McCoy is arguing with Spock and brought us to this moment where he realizes that he is wrong. And at the end of that final message, as it fades out, there is a there are a few beats, and McCoy says,
Spock, I'm sorry. It does hurt, doesn't it?
And Spock's response, the humanity that Spock that McCoy was trying to reach out to, the humanity that he was trying to reach into, is played out when Spock says,
"What would you have me say, Doctor?"
It's so great.
It really has to do with Bill. I watched dailies on him for a whole season over at TJ Hooker.
Wow.
And one of the things that Rick Husky said one day was, look at that man. He controls the screen. He is a great actor. You're looking at a great actor. Because when he's on screen, you don't look at anybody else. And that struck me as being exactly what you're talking about here. You're on a little tiny screen with this man, and he still controls the whole scene.
Did you have the experience, Judy? I've seen this several times where you saw them shoot the thing in real life and you went, oh, that was okay. That's pretty good. And then you watched it in the dailies and went, where did that come from? Like, it's just totally different.
Yeah, you know, not so much because I really didn't go looking at a lot of the show. It was the first three or four shows that I wrote. I was Johnny on the spot to watch him film.
Right.
But after that, it just became laborious to go sit and watch him play Liar's Poker while they waited for setups. And so it impacted me tremendously here to see what came out of the shooting. And I can tell you, once again, Ralph Sinensky just nailed it.
Yeah, it sure did.
For those people out there who've never been on a movie set and you have some idea that it's this exciting, dynamic place, if you don't have a job there, it is real boring.
Yeah, it is.
It is a boring place. If you're the director or the cinematographer or the AD, it's a super busy place.
Yeah, but or if craft, you're just the, craft services, maybe.
Your craft service or one of the art dogs, you're working all the time. I want to just this moment of what would you have me say, Doctor? I think there is a direct connection between this moment and the jail cell in Bread and Circuses. I think in both scenes, McCoy has been pushing Spock. And in both scenes, the end of it is that Spock is emotional and deeply worried about his best friend. And McCoy wasn't able to see it until the end.
Right.
Is that Spock's got to keep it together here.
You are so right. In both situations, Spock is trying to keep it together and he is overwhelmed by circumstances way beyond his control. I mean, of course, being in a jail cell and in this case, a multitude of factors against his favor. And in both cases, McCoy is going after him, trying to reach into his human side. And in the end, what happens? McCoy gets that human side and then he feels bad about it, because he feels like he went too far.
And just at this moment, we get a hail that we have an estimate on the Tholians completing their tractor field. And Spock says, again, being the captain, but I think in a slightly different way from how he was being the captain before seeing Kirk's tape, is he says,
Doctor, I believe we each have our respective tasks to complete before the Tholians complete theirs.
They're a team now.
And then we cut to a very unusual place, which is Uhura's quarters.
This is actually the second time we've seen Uhura's quarters. The first time, Uhura wasn't in those quarters because she had selflessly given them up for the Domend of Alas in a land of Troyes before she completely trashed the place. But it was such a nice, like I love these moments because we didn't see a whole lot of them, but when we did see them, they were fully realized and effective. Seeing Uhura in her quarters in civilian clothing, she reaches in to put a necklace to her drawer to put a necklace on. And as she puts it on, she feels a pain. And the space is affecting everybody in different ways. Like Judy pointed out, it's definitely affecting McCoy in very, very subtle ways. Obviously, we've seen the effects of it on Chekhov. And now we're seeing the effect of the space on Uhura, where she kind of doubles over in pain. And as she composes herself, she looks at herself in the mirror. And who does she see in the mirror but the floating image in his spacesuit of Captain Kirk?
And she naturally kind of freaks out and runs to find Spock, finds McCoy instead, says, I've just seen the captain. And I like McCoy's bedside manner. He's like,
of course you have, Uhura. We would all like to see the
captain. He's alive. He's alive, Doctor.
Of course.
Believe me, I did see him. I did. Spock! Mr. Spock!
And then she faints. And again, I think we're ahead because I think we know she really saw him.
Yeah.
But nobody else believes that she really saw him. And then we're in the engine room, and this is what we mentioned before, where one of the guys, obviously affected by the space, attacks Scotty, and we just have this sense of this is going to get worse and worse and worse. In sick bay, Chekhov is in restraints, screaming and struggling as only Chekhov can.
Dr. McCoy.
Yes, nurse.
I have a diagnosis of the crewman who attacked Engineer Scott. It was definitely due to the deteriorating effects of interspace.
To which I wrote, excuse my language, no
Yeah. thanks for that report.
Like, I think we all kind of knew that, but
yeah.
Uhura is watching Chekhov scream.
Mr. Spock didn't believe me either, did he, Doctor?
Well, nobody saw it but you, Uhura.
And then, this moment is very touching and scary to me.
Will I become like Chekhov, Doctor?
No, oh, no. We're working hard. We'll find an antidote.
To be on a bed next to someone who is totally freaking out and going insane, and I know that I have the same disease that they have, that's really scary.
It's scary. And don't you think, both of you, don't you think that Nichelle Nichols' performance in this scene is just really, really terrific?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Very sensitive.
And just so you know, they wanted her to have this scene. She was in, like I told you, an earlier scene in the chapel where she went down. But she was not the one who saw Kirk or Spock in the very first draft. They wanted to give Nichelle a chance to shine.
Oh.
So we wrote it this way.
Scott to bridge.
Bridge, Spock here.
Are we slipping into interspace?
Negative. We are relatively stable at the moment.
Why do you ask?
And Scotty sees something, and there, again, is the floating Captain Kirk.
I don't believe it.
Back on the bridge, McCoy enters, and we hear,
Mr. Spock, I've just seen Captain Kirk. He was standing there just as plain as we are, and then he just disappeared.
That sounds like a horror story. You suppose there's any truth in it?
In critical moments, men sometimes see exactly what they wish to see.
So, first of all, I would believe them more than I think Spock and McCoy are believing that this thing is happening.
Right, I agree.
I think so, except once again, you know, things are so crazy. And they saw what was on the other ship, at least
true.
McCoy did.
Yeah.
You know, they all went nuts and all killed each other.
Yeah.
So, are we sure they're not going crazy? Just crazy. With Spock, I'm not so sure that he might not have believed him.
I wish McCoy did not have the next line here. He says,
do you suppose they're seeing Jim because they've lost confidence in you?
That was a line that makes sense to me before you saw Kirk's tape. It makes less sense to me now because it feels really mean, frankly.
Well, also, so Scotty is saying that he saw Captain Kirk. Uhura said she saw Captain Kirk. So how can they both be wrong? But like Judy pointed out, the effect of the space is affecting McCoy because, you know, what is Spock's response to McCoy at this moment?
I was merely stating a fact, Doctor.
It's getting critical. There have been a number of salts down on the lower decks. Even Scotty's being affected. If Scotty goes under, that's the finish of whatever chance we have of getting the Enterprise out of here.
Which I like that line a lot. How much really depends upon Scotty.
Please leave that to me, Dr. McCoy. I realize that the crew are your prime concern. You can best serve them in your laboratory. I urge you to confine yourself to it until a remedy has been found.
Just a comment on this moment. This, and forgive me, Judy, but this kind of is my one criticism of this episode, is that what Spock just said is very much what he'd been saying before the scene with Kirk. And I wish we saw more specifically them using Kirk's advice.
Me too. But you got to realize a big chunk of that kind of stuff got cut. Once upon a time, the script that was before this script had a lot of that and less of this. This was Arthur Singer's view of how to maintain tension.
Right.
And you wrote for Arthur or you didn't write. You know, right. And God bless him. I worked for Arthur several times more. One of the great story editors of that period of time in Hollywood. But he was very single-minded about what he wanted this to do.
When he was single-minded, Judy, when he was, especially because you and Chet were like just getting baby. Started with this, what was he like as a mentor, was he nurturing with you?
Yes.
Was he like to the point? Like how was he as a mentor, as a collaborator?
He was great. You know, there was another mentor over at Marcus Welby that was the same kind. They were old Hollywood story editors, took you by the hand and tried to get you to write the script. In New Hollywood, the story editor just took the script away from you and wrote it themselves.
Oh,
and that happened the day the residuals became in perpetuity, when they were going to get money for everything that their name was on. They stopped being like Arthur Singer. Arthur Singer was wonderful, but he had a mindset. And the mindset included Chekhov going out of his head, which was not in there originally. And all of these small nuances between Nimoy and DeForest Kelly.
Yep.
Because Bobby Justman had said, this is the way we want to go. So every time you got a chance to punch it, even if it was going into overdrive, right. Which it was, I guarantee you, I think the same thing you think. Too much. Too much.
Yeah. Well, and here's specifically the thing that I would want. I would want the moment where Spock is trying to figure a thing out, hits a wall, and then pauses, and then asks McCoy's advice, because that's what Kirk told him to do. And I want the moment where McCoy is about to come back at Spock and say something really argumentative and stops himself and says, aye, Captain. Gives him the loyalty.
Wish you'd been there. Yeah. I would have loved it. I would have taken your advice.
That's great.
Steve is great with the rewrites.
But the next moment is really great.
After basically butting heads with Spock from the point that they got back to the Enterprise from the Defiant, McCoy swings Spock around in his chair in just a fit of rage and frustration and says, Spock, like he just completely loses it. And at the same time that he loses it, presumably from the effects of the area, the space that they're in, he also comes to his senses.
Yep.
And it goes from being a really dramatic moment to a really touching moment, because McCoy says,
must be this space is getting to me too. I know it's nothing you've done, Spock. I'm sorry.
At the moment of this high tension with the web being built around the Enterprise, and they're still trying to, maybe Kirk is still alive, even though we just declared him dead. Spock says this really, really touching line.
It's a great
and in the effect that McCoy has reached into his humanity after all, in which he says,
I understand, Doctor. I'm sure the captain would simply have said, forget it, Bones.
That is a really, like, touching line that, again, makes you feel the presence of Captain Kirk, even though he is not there.
Yep. I like that line.
Yeah, I love it.
Well
love
done.
It.
Because and it also shows Spock's love for Kirk and his understanding of Kirk, and that he understands Kirk's relationship to McCoy. There's so much in it.
They considered this a transition episode.
Mm.
An episode that set the triangle for everything else that was going to happen down the line.
Oh, interesting. That's really cool. Interesting. Yeah.
That was Bobby Justman working.
Bob Justman.
McCoy starts to faint. Scotty steps onto the bridge, and right at that moment, he says, Mr. Spock, look. And there floating on the bridge is Captain Kirk.
Now, the cat is out of the bag. It turns out Scotty and Uhura were right all along. They are seeing Captain Kirk. Spock is now seeing him. McCoy is now seeing him. Everyone on the bridge is seeing Captain Kirk. So he is alive. But it is still a chilling scene because the image of Kirk in his spacesuit floating, you can see through him. He's kind of transparent. Spock walks towards him. And as he is walking towards him, he's saying, Captain, Captain. Not just to like connect, Captain, but also there's something in Spock's voice that's saying, Captain, help.
Well, and watch Kirk. He's trying to speak and we can't hear him.
That's so good. It's so good the way you can read Kirk's lips saying, help me, Spock. And because you just know how much these three care about each other. And he's missing his friend and his commander. And he's saying, Captain, like he's almost like, help me to help you. What do I do? Yeah. How can we help you? And then he disappears. And that brings us to the end. Another great cliffhanger end. This one for the end of Act 3.
Captain Kirk's alive?
We all saw him. The captain's still alive.
And the relief on Uhura's face that she's not going crazy is big. And then we're with Spock and Scotty in Spock's quarters. They figured out when the next interface will come. And then in comes McCoy with a big carafe of Tranya?
It does look like Tranya. Yeah, it sure does.
And he says, and it's so funny that they've managed to have McCoy, the scientist with the antidote, simultaneously be McCoy, the bartender with the cocktails.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's a diluted Theragun derivative. Theragun. A nerve gas used by the Klingons.
Aye, and deadly too.
What are you thinking of, Doc? You're trying to kill us all.
And then what you hear is like, no, it's only deadly in the pure form.
That's right. And in this derivative, mixed with alcohol, it merely deadens certain nerve inputs to the brain.
Oh, well, any decent blend of scotch will do that.
Well, one good slug of this, and you could hit a man with phaser stun, and he'd never feel it or even know it.
This next moment, Scotty's alcoholism is a kind of an interesting thread in the show.
Sure is.
Because after taking a shot of this thing that sounds like it'll really mess you up, he says,
does it make a good mix with scotch?
It should.
I'll let you know.
It takes the whole carafe. And I'm like, Scotty, can you wait till after the emergency to get hammered? I mean,
Look at the way Scotty wanted to, sort of take a shot of the bourbon, inspector of the gun, even though the gas was painless. And what does he do to defeat the Kelvins in by any other name? He drinks them under the table. Yeah, Scotty knows what he's doing.
I kind of would like to see. Oh, I just thought of it. Is Scotty versus Marion from Raiders of the Lost Ark in a drinking contest?
Oh, there you go.
Who goes down first?
Oh, I don't know. I think Scotty can send a drinker under the table, actually.
I mean, Scotty's got more body mass. That might help him out, but I don't know. Marion's pretty tough.
He's just used to it.
Well, drink it down, Spock. It's the human thing to do. That's a medical order.
And I like this.
Captain.
What an arc of their relationship just in this episode.
Yeah.
The way that it kind of peaks with the aftermath of listening to Kirk's final recorded message. And then again on the bridge when McCoy swings Spock around in anger and frustration to this moment where he's, you know, and this actually brings me to my next question, Steve. You and I have talked about many times about the evolution of Spock as a commanding officer, going from his first command in the Galileo 7 to now here we are in the Tholian Web. And Spock is really dealing with, I would say, the most challenging part of his command throughout his time aboard the Enterprise so far.
Absolutely.
And how do you think he's doing, Steve?
It's funny that you say that, because that's literally my note for the next scene. Because the next scene, we're on the bridge, and Uhura and Chekov show back up.
Welcome back, Lieutenant.
Thank you, sir.
Your absence was keenly felt, Mr. Chekov.
Thank you, Mr. Spock.
And the note that I wrote down was Galileo. Is Galileo. The distance between the commander of the Galileo 7, who was totally inhuman, working entirely on logic, didn't care about the emotional journey of his crew, and ended up being a really bad commander because of it, now has the sensitivity, has learned to check in with his crew members and show appreciation for them and make them feel like part of the team. So I think it's night and day, Spock's yep. journey as a leader since the Galileo 7. It is absolutely huge.
For sure. And when you look at Spock's failures in the Galileo 7, some of it because of the way he addressed his crew in the Galileo 7, especially when they were stranded on the planet, to now you're back on the Enterprise, the positive reinforcement mm-hmm. that Spock shows by welcoming Uhura back, by welcoming Chekov back, and by appealing to them professionally and personally, is not a Spock that we would have been able to see in the Galileo 7. His evolution as a commander is fantastic.
And I think, much like some of the best episodes of Star Trek, like the Doomsday Machine, we have all those ticking clocks are coming together right in this moment. It's a huge amount of tension because the Tholians are about to finish up their web. The phasing moment is coming up in which we're going to have to do something. Scotty is trying to get us up to full power. We're only at 76%. And then Uhura sees Kirk kind of floating at the view screen, and we know that his air is running out. So all of these ticking clocks are coming right to this moment.
Sir, the tractor field is activated.
We're being pulled out of here.
Engineering, bring ship's power up to full capability.
And we hit it, and we have a shake, and then the Enterprise disappears.
Gone.
And then we're looking out at the screen, and it's black, and the black view screen switches to stars, and we realize that we've escaped the Tholian web.
And hopefully, because the captain was caught in the transporter beam while they were phased out, thrown clear of the Tholian web, hopefully that brought Captain Kirk with them to where they are now. And it is the moment of truth for them to beam the captain aboard the Enterprise. And after some difficulties again with the transporter, because they were just thrown clear of the Tholian web, we see the image of Kirk. And we see here this rousing music that is playing behind the transporter as Kirk is beaming aboard the Enterprise. And he falls to his knees after his incredible ordeal with his oxygen running out. McCoy helps him take off the helmet, and he is gasping for air. McCoy fills him with some triox compound. Kirk is home.
It's great. I think it is a great, great moment of yep. triumph for the crew of the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. Well done, Judy. And we're back on the bridge, and we hear Kirk sort of marveling at this totally unique experience he had.
I had a whole universe to myself after the Defiant was thrown out. There was absolutely no one else in it. I must say I prefer a crowded universe much better.
So this tag, as we call it, because it's the tag to the whole episode, was filmed on the same day as the teaser, because you had Shatner in his his Starfleet yeah. uniform. So they filmed the teaser, and then they filmed the tag. And that means that this was filmed on day 3 by Ralph Sinetsky.
And Kirk asks, how did you get along without me?
Oh, we managed. Mr. Spock gave the orders, and I found the answers.
Which I think other people found answers too, but that's okay. And now Kirk is fishing a little bit.
Good. No problems between you.
None worth reporting, Captain.
I think Jim Kirk was really proud of those final orders. He thinks he did a great job, and he is fishing for them. He's like, come on.
Tell me it worked.
And finally, Kirk just ups and asks them the question.
Well, I hope my last orders were helpful in solving any problems that you don't feel worth reporting.
And there is a look between them.
Orders, Captain.
And now McCoy and Spock play a real good game of yes and improv. And they're each on the same page. And they base this whole Vulcans don't lie thing. That's not true because they're about to lie their butts off.
Well, no, wait a minute, Steve. He's exaggerating.
No, he's lying. It's a lie.
Yeah, that was the whole idea.
Oh, those orders. Well, there wasn't time. We never had a chance to listen to them.
No, you see, the crisis was upon us and then passed so quickly, Captain, that we never...
So I'm going to say two simultaneously things about this moment. A, I think it's really funny. B, I don't like it.
Why? Because I love it.
Because it's mean. I think it's mean to Kirk. I think this is, I mean, the guy died, gave you the orders that saved the ship with its deep wisdom that made everything better, and you lie about the fact that you never heard him. I don't know. I don't like it.
See,
but it is really funny. It's a funny moment.
The reason I like it is because Spock and McCoy do not want Kirk to be led on in any way that they had ever given up hope that he was still alive. That's I think they're showing empathy by saying we never doubted for a moment that you would not return to the Enterprise, that you would be okay. We were right there with you every step of the way.
I don't know. They had a funeral for him.
There was an entirely different tag, just so you know.
Oh, so
there was. Let's hear it.
Oh, I couldn't even. I'd have to read the whole thing to you. But basically, it was it had to do more with what they went through and what Kirk went through, and it had nothing to do with the comedy. The comedy was asked for. So in other words, they went from what was basically a much more drier tag to something that was comedic. And so this is what we wrote, but there was a tag that was completely different in tone and everything. Just so you know.
That's good to know.
That brings us to the end of the Tholine Web. Scott, I'm curious if anyone had anything interesting to say about this episode of television.
Well, Mike Miner, who we talked about thoroughly throughout this episode, said that was the one episode I worked the longest on. It involved 3 or 4 months out of Vanderveer optical effects. I storyboarded the 17 cuts of effects that the script called for, shot the raw footage, and executed all of the animation plates. I'm told there was about $90,000 of optical bills on that one show alone.
Wow.
That was Mike Miner. And then Ralph Senensky said, no one ever talked to me about it after I left Freddie Freiberger's office, except for Gene Roddenberry. The only conversation ever. Gene called me right after it happened. He was apologetic, angry, and sympathetic. It was a lovely call. He was a very sensitive man, a sweetheart. So
that's what I'm telling you. It was not Gene and it was not Freddie. It was Doug.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe that, especially after Freiberger's confidant mentioned that Douglas Kramer was a real hard ass. And I don't doubt it. You know, I wasn't there, but
he was a creative genius. Don't get me wrong. He really was. I worked with him for a year over in Vegas, but he could just slice and dice if he had to. And I think he made that creative decision. I'm sorry.
Because the Tholine Web, Judy, has become such a beloved Star Trek classic over the last 55 years, what has your relationship been with the Tholine Web? How do you feel about the way this episode has endured and the way it has become so iconic, especially because of the imagery of the web building around the Enterprise?
Want to know what my icon in Facebook is?
What's that?
It's the VHS version of the Tholine Web.
Oh.
Okay. Cool. You don't see my face. You see the Tholine Web. It changed my life.
Oh,
really?
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
I was going to go be an anthropologist in Africa.
Wow.
And instead became a writer in television and a producer and a, you know, story editor and everything that you can do. It was all because of this. You know, it's like if you were ever fated to do something, I feel like I was fated to do this. And I cannot be prouder to have worked with these people who were so imaginative and so good at what they were doing that they made me look good, gave me other jobs.
Have you ever heard from, like, over the years from fans who have told you what they like this, like what were some of the reactions you gotten from the fans when you met them and they knew that you co-wrote the episode with Chet?
Let me give you one fan that you might remember, Harv Bennett. Harv Bennett called me into the office. I'd worked with him on $6 Million Man and on Salvage and on American Girls. And he called me into an office over at Paramount and said, I had never seen Star Trek before, but I watched all the scripts. That's why you're here. Oh. Because it was amazing. And he said, do you want to rewrite Wrath of Khan? And I went, no. You know, after reading, I read it for him and gave him notes, tons of notes, including, just so you know, the scene where Kirk goes down and puts the hands up on the plate between he and Leonard when Leonard's dying.
Yeah.
Kirk was never in that shot to begin with. And I said to him, you're missing the one shot that everybody in the whole world wants to see, which is these people bonding at the very end. They all three have to be there.
And Judy.
They all were there. But, you know, I felt like he wanted to do it so badly. You could smell it, wanted to do it. But he was so kind. He just said, this episode was the one that moved me most.
Wow. So, well, first of all, Judy, I mean, that's incredible news that he gave you the chance to work on the screenplay for The Wrath of Khan. How come you didn't do it?
He gave me a show to do instead.
Oh, okay.
It didn't last forever, but The Powers of Matthew Starr was the show I got to work on. Oh, I love
The Powers of Matthew Starr. Yeah, that was great.
And he said, what do you want? And I said, I'll take the show.
Oh, you know,
but mostly because I felt like no matter what I did, he would rewrite it because he wanted to do it so badly.
Sure.
You could tell how much he loved that idea. He spent hours telling me all about how he put it together. And he and I was at the studio the whole time that was being shot. So, you know, it was amazing. But that's a fan that you take some love for.
Oh, you know? Sure. Absolutely. That's a good fan, Harv Bennett.
Well, and honestly, I think that, you know, Spock's death and Kirk there is arguably might be the greatest moment in all of Star Trek. And the fact that you were contributing to that scene with notes, that's amazing.
It wasn't there. He was up on the bridge. Spock died with Kirk on the bridge.
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah, you did the right thing by saying, Kirk should be down there in engineering with Spock
actually,
for this moment.
When you think about it, all four of the biggies were there.
Right.
You know, that was the whole idea is the tetra, whatever you want to call it, the foursome. You know, McCoy was there and so was Scotty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. You know, but you had to have that moment between these two men because he's dying. And well, I told him the last thing I told him was, you can't kill him. Sorry. You know, they were determined to kill him because that's what Leonard wanted.
Right.
And I said, I don't care what Leonard wants. The fandom will not let you kill him. And within 2 months, the studio said, he's not dead. Fix it.
I was already happy, Judy, that the original series decided to pick up your original script. But now I'm even more happy that they did it, because if they hadn't, not only would we not have the Tholian web, but we might not have one of the most important scenes in Star Trek history.
For sure.
So I it's funny, you know, we've talked about the bad rap that season three gets, and each episode we're doing, the batting average just goes up and up. And this is a really strong episode that I would think would be just as at home in the second season. There's so many things to be tense about. There's so much character development, and it's really, really satisfying at the very end where everything comes together and we manage to rescue Captain Kirk. I think it's a really solid episode of Star Trek.
And also, even though there was a lot of drama behind the scenes, a really, really unfortunate and unfair on the part of director Ralph Senensky, the bottom line is what he directed was among the finest work of his career in Star Trek because of how effective it was for this episode, and the obstacles that he had to deal with regards to the spacesuits being taking too long to get put on, and of course a new cinematographer, and yet his work still stands out, and it is the reason why this episode is so very, very effective. So
I agree.
So kudos, Judy, to you and Chet. Very much kudos to Ralph and the entire cast. And you know, ultimately, it is a standout episode. It is one that I've always, always loved. It's definitely on my regular rewatch list. It's one that I watch all the time. I'm like, I'm in the mood for Star Trek. I'm in the mood for Tholian Web. And I'm going to watch the original effects. Steve, any closing thoughts for you about Tholian Web?
No, I feel like I've given them, but I do think, you know, as we see the evolution of these characters, this is one more big, huge step in the evolution of McCoy and Spock. So I think it's a fantastic episode.
I think you guys have done a great job for it, too. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. And listen, Judy, we thank you so very much for joining us for the duration of this conversation on the Tholian Web. And it has been an absolute delightful joy to speak with you and to meet you officially. Again, I mean, you got to keep in mind, Judy, in 1974, 75, when I was like 6 years old, watching Star Trek for the first time, and I see the beginning of Act One, the Tholian Web, written by Judy Burns and Chet Richards. I never imagined that I would get a chance to talk to you with Steve here at such great length about the making of this episode. So we are so, so grateful for your time, your insight, your passion, your behind the scenes. And just thank you so, so very much.
Thank you for asking me.
It really was a true, true pleasure, Judy. Thank you.
And now that you've heard all about the making of the Tholian Web, be sure to check out Star Trek Continues. I've mentioned Star Trek Continues many times here on Enterprise Incidents. And if you want a continuation of everything that was great about the original series, Star Trek Continues is the way to go. An amazing fan series. And there's an episode called Still Treads the Shadow, which is written by Judy Burns, who is the co-writer of the Tholian Web. And if you want to know what happened to Kirk while he was in the interface, then you should watch the Star Trek Continues episode Still Treads the Shadow. It is really fantastic. Please do check it out, and so you can actually continue the story of the Tholian Web.
And of course, we would love to hear what everyone else thinks of the Tholian Web. The first place that we have the most action is on our Facebook page. Do a search for Enterprise Incidents. But hey, we're also on Twitter, if that's your thing. It's under Enter Incidents. We're on Instagram at Enterprise Incidents. And if you haven't already subscribed to the show, what are you waiting for? You should get on Apple Podcasts if that's the service you use and subscribe. But if you're not an Apple person, it's on Spotify, it's on Stitcher, or you could even listen to it on YouTube. It's audio only, but we have a lot of people that listen on YouTube, and you can leave your comments there. Please leave your reviews on Apple Podcasts. And if you wanted to reach me, you could find me at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. And if you wanted to, I'm not going to plug my other podcast, The Cinephiles. We talk so much about writing and directing. I'm going to plug my own feature film that I produced, wrote, directed, and edited. It's called The Assistants, and it's a Hollywood caper movie that stars Joe Mantegna, Jane Seymour, and Stacey Keach. And it is available on the Cinephiles site on YouTube. So that's, you could check that out. Oh, thank you, Judy. And Scott, how would people find you?
You can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at Movie Mance. And please be sure, this is really, really important, please be sure to share Enterprise Incidents on your social media pages so that you can beam aboard Enterprise Incidents and see what we've been doing for the original series. We've been so deeply moved and grateful for all of the rave reviews and awesome comments we've gotten from our fans, our listeners, our enterprisers. That's what we've been calling the fans of Enterprise Incidents, our enterprisers who have been so, so, so very great. And if you really want to support us, in addition to writing a review for Enterprise Incidents on Apple Podcasts, Steve, how can people support us over at Anchor?
you just go to the show notes, which is on every single version of the podcast, including the one on YouTube. And the first thing you'll see is a link to our site on Anchor, where you can subscribe to the show for as little as 99 cents a month. What else can you get for 99 cents a month? And we really appreciate even that 99 cents. We really appreciate that support. This show is something that we love doing, but it is a lot of work, and any little bit you can give will definitely help.
Absolutely. And we are grateful to everyone who has already supported us through Anchor. If you haven't done so yet, then please join us. And we really, really do appreciate your support. And wow, what a great conversation this was for the Tholian Web. And I'm just as excited for the conversation, the deep dive that we are going to have on our very next episode of Enterprise Incidents, which is a McCoy story, a really special McCoy story. It is a love story. And it is a beautiful episode called For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. That is next on Enterprise Incidents. So join us for the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. And until then, keep going boldly.